Good evening and welcome to Your Legal Rights. My name is Jeff Hayden. Tonight, my guests are Kelly Armstrong and Matthew Vandal. Kelly Armstrong is here in the studio with me. She is the founding partner of the Armstrong Law Firm, which represents employees in harassment, discrimination, and unfair employment practices. Based in San Francisco and rated by her peers in Northern California's 5% of employment discrimination attorneys. Matt Vandal is with us over the phone. He's an employment litigator based in Sacramento. His practice is focused on the representation of for the past 15 years or more than that, he's been focused on the representation of employers and management and included being a partner in the nation's largest law firm dedicated exclusively in defending employers in labor and employment matters. Today, he is representing employees, and I would like to welcome both of you. If you wish to call, you can talk to both of my guests by calling on air. Our number is 866-798-8255 or 415-841-4134. Our topic tonight, as you might have gleaned, is an hour's worth of discussion on sexual harassment in the workplace, its definitions, its legal remedies in our evolving workplaces, something that we've all been watching over recent weeks unfolding with some very high-profile matters. I'd like to welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you. Good evening, Jeff. I'm delighted to be here talking about sexual harassment in the post-Weinstein era. Good evening, Jeff, and hello, Matt.
Hi. I'm grateful to be here as well. Looking forward to the chat. It's interesting to see these issues coming out from both sides of the fence, on the employer side and now on the employee side. So it should be an interesting discussion.
Time's up.
So it's an interesting phrase, time's up, and we'll get to that because it does sound like things are changing in the workplace. But my first question is open to both of you. I'd like you to tell me, really, what is sexual harassment? Or more particularly, what really rises to the level of sexual harassment?
Go ahead.
It's interesting, you know, sexual harassment has been developing over the years, but what you need to look at here is whether the conduct is considered severe or pervasive conduct. There are a couple different types of claims that can come forward. You know, you can look at verbal harassment, such as derogatory comments or slurs or sexual jokes in the workplace. You can have physical harassment where someone is touching you, sexual assault or even physical interference with your movement, blocking you from getting out of the kitchen or keeping you in a corner, that sort of thing. There can be visual harassment, you know, cartoons or pornographic materials that are being displayed at the workplace or even found. Sexual advances from a superior or even a coworker that are unwanted. There's a separate type of claim where certain employee benefits or job promotions or job demotions are conditioned on the exchange of sexual favors. And, you can have verbal abuse of a sexual nature and just sexually degrading words in the workplace. So the standards for, say, a hostile work environment claim, which is what a lot of the litigation comes down to, is this standard, severe or pervasive standard. And so severe means essentially something physically threatening or humiliating versus a single offensive utterance. You could see a severe claim being established by something as terrible as a sexual assault or a sexual battery in the workplace. That sort of thing could allow a victim to come forward and have rights. They also have rights if the situation is pervasive. And now that means continuous conduct over a period of time. So you'll have possibly lesser conduct. All of it's outrageous, in my view, but lesser conduct, comments, these offensive jokes, happening repeatedly over time, whether it's directly to the victim or something the victim observes.
But let me ask you a question. I understand that there's different gradations, different levels of harassment that fall into different categories. But before we get there, I think a more fundamental question is, at what point is it really inappropriate harassment? At what point is an offhand comment unacceptable to the point where litigation is appropriate or where somebody really needs to go after remedies. Kelly, kind of where do we start with this? At what point is the line crossed?
Right. So you can think of it in layperson terms in terms of a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the highest in terms of the worst sexual harassment conduct. 1 could be, oh, you look really nice today. And 10 would be sexual assault. So we have all types of things in the middle, and the definition for what rises to the level of sexual harassment is things that conduct that dramatically alters the terms and conditions of your employment. So there's not a black and white definition, but it's at a point where you feel that the terms and conditions of your employment have been dramatically altered and unable to be brought back to where they were before.
At some point, we're starting with the presumption that someone in power is talking to somebody who's somewhat subordinate, and that's being exploited for purposes of harassment. But do you ever see it where someone in a lesser position speaks up to somebody maybe equally inappropriately, but it's not a subordinate, but rather somebody above them?
Where a lower-level person is sexually harassing a higher-level person?
Yes.
Yeah, that, you know, anything can happen in the world of sexual harassment, and certainly that can happen, especially at holiday parties, conferences in Las Vegas, and off-site meetings. It is rare. It is rare.
So, Matt, based on all the years you've been doing this, you're probably the one I would want to know. You get a complaint. What steps should the employer do?
Well, the employer has to do a prompt and thorough investigation right off the bat. So they can't delay, they can't stall. They really need to look into it and make sure that they're going to take what's called prompt corrective action if they find some merit to the allegations. So there are all sorts of things an employer can do in that context. Oftentimes, the complaint may get to an HR representative, and that person may conduct an investigation. Sometimes an employee might report it to their supervisor. Sometimes the supervisor is the harasser. But in all of those different circumstances, the employer is required to take immediate action. If they can, they'll try to separate the harasser and the victim or the accused harasser. And that could include something like a schedule change or a transfer to another location while an investigation takes place and the employer tries to confirm or refute the allegations. I think it's really important in today's day and age for the employer to be particularly sensitive to the complaints of women coming forward or even men coming forward. It's really difficult to come forward and tell your employer you're being harassed, just by the fear of retaliation and such. And so employers really have to set in place policies and procedures that address that and are helpful to the employee and make sure that they can root out the problem and do something about it.
You know, I would also add, related to sexual harassment by subordinate employees, one of the key distinctions in California, Jeff, is if a coworker sexually harasses you, you have to report it to HR and give them a chance to fix it. And if they don't make it stop and it happens again, then liability for damages can arise from that. However, if a supervisor sexually harasses you in the workplace, the employer is automatically or strictly liable for that conduct, and you could be entitled to monetary damages for sexual harassment by a supervisor automatically.
So even if the entity as a whole takes steps to correct it right away, they're already on the hook because of the liability they have because it came from an employer or from a supervisor.
Absolutely. That's the law in California under the Fair Employment and Housing Act, FEHA.
Yeah, well, you know, the employer is placing that supervisor in a position to make decisions about hiring and firing and imposing discipline. And so they're sort of standing in the shoes of the employer as the supervisor, and it's correct that they should be held directly liable for their conduct if they don't train them properly, if they're not overseeing them, that sort of thing.
Supervisors are held to a much higher standard in California, and they're also, if the company is large enough, they're required to undergo mandatory sexual harassment training every 2 years. So they're held to a very high standard in our state.
Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights. Our topic tonight is employment sexual harassment in the workplace. My guests tonight again are Matt Vandal from Sacramento and Kelly Armstrong from San Francisco. If you have a question for our guest, feel free to call 866-798-8255. And one of the things that has been huge in the news in the last year are the sheer wave of people coming forward talking about acts that took place years and years ago. We've heard a couple of very, very large cases that dominate the news. I'm going to ask that we can talk about the cases if it illustrates based on these types of complaints, but I'm going to ask that we don't comment on individual cases, of course. But we've seen a number of claims come forward, people that are talking for the first time about things that happened 10 or 15 years ago. The obvious question people have with a delayed claim is, why didn't somebody come forward sooner? Kelly, can you explain that?
Because women for so long have been dominated in the workplace and subjugated by the power structure. So even today and throughout our labor history, women have been afraid to come forward because they're fearful of retaliation, they're fearful of losing their jobs, they're fearful of feeling stigmatized in the workplace. So it really comes from a place of fear, especially for women whose income from their jobs is essential to meet their monthly expenses and to take care of their family.
So we now have a wave of claims that have come in. They have taken place over the course of years or even decades. What effect is this on an employer? Matt, how does an employer deal with that? What kind of special problems emerges?
Well, an employer is always going to have a PR problem with an old claim, particularly if they're a high-profile employer. They may not really be subject to a risk of litigation for a complaint that old. I think if there's a current employee complaining about something that long ago, the employer should still investigate it to the extent they can. But employers aren't required to maintain records indefinitely. So you can have problems just looking into the complaint, seeing even if the employees or the witnesses are even still there or alive or able to be reached in any fashion. It's really difficult for an employer to go back that far and confirm what's being done. Unless, of course, the accused and the harasser are still working there and others have seen it and can confirm the allegation.
There are two legal angles for claims that were a long time ago. One that we've seen recently in the news is if the perpetrator or harasser says that you're lying if you come forward with your claim years later, you can potentially sue them for defamation. The second angle, which was the legal theory for a lawsuit that was filed against Harvey Weinstein in New York. We have shorter statutes of limitations for these claims, but the legal theory that was used in New York for a claim that was several years ago was to use a federal sex trafficking statute. So in that statute, it requires that a sexual benefit be conferred in exchange for an economic benefit. So that also meets the definition for employment. And the statute of limitations for that federal sex trafficking law is 10 years. So that potentially, we will probably see some new law on it, but that can potentially give women whose claims go back 10 years the opportunity to come forward.
Grant from San Francisco, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Grant, are you there?
Well, yes. How does bullying in the workplace how does that fit in with this conversation? Sexual harassment is horrible and should not happen in the workplace. I agree with that. But also, the same scars come from a bullying situation. How is the employee protected by the state when it comes to that versus sexual advances?
Hi, Grant.
Grant, I'm going to ask if you would take your answer on the air. We're getting a bit of feedback from the call.
Absolutely.
But I do appreciate the question, and thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for the question. Unfortunately, bullying is not unlawful in the workplace right now. So if you wanted to bring a claim for bullying, it would need to be framed as being based on your being in a protected group somehow. So it could be based on your sexual orientation, your religion, your disability, your age, etc. If you fear for your physical safety, you could complain to the employer, and then they're on notice that somebody is threatening your physical safety. And then ultimately, if something happened after that, you might have a negligent retention claim and potentially an assault claim. But it takes us out of the harassment, the legal harassment arena, unless you can make it based on your being in a protected group.
Right, and even that is challenging because what I'm seeing, and I just had a sort of bullying to a protected category case, the employer is often just saying, look, we admit this person's a bully, but they're an equal opportunity bully. They're bullying everyone at work. And as Kelly mentioned, that's still okay under the law. But what you need to show is, sure, they're bullying everyone, but they're bullying this protected class even more. And if you can establish that, it might get you further along the line, but it can be very challenging to do that.
I also think we get a lot of calls from employees who are being abused by aggressive, angry bosses. And I think that if your boss is bullying you to the point where you develop a psychological disability, such as anxiety, depression, panic attacks, etc., you can then, if you're diagnosed that way by a psychologist or an MD, you can then put your employer on notice that you have a disability, and that can provide you potentially with protection against your harasser for bullying you. You could potentially argue disability harassment if they're on notice that you had a medical condition and continued to bully you.
And I would also suggest that victims of bullying try to come forward in the workplace as well. You want to put your employer on notice of this person, like Kelly just mentioned. Let them investigate. They may not be required to do that, but a savvy employer is going to look into a victim's complaints, take them seriously, hear them, and see if there's something they can do about it.
But don't complain to your employer unless you have a lawyer advising you in the background. A lawyer can help you ghostwrite the wording of your complaint, your protected activity, because if you come forward and you make a complaint based on being in a protected group and you're terminated shortly thereafter, it creates an inference of retaliation under California and federal law. And that's actually one of the easiest claims for Matt and I to establish for our clients. So you don't want to make any complaints to your employer without an attorney advising you. And also, if the employer is going to do an investigation, they're going to want to interview you. We don't allow the employers to interview our clients unless we're present, and we also don't allow that to happen until we've had an opportunity to have our clients prepare a chronology, digest all of the information, and prepare a comprehensive summary which best presents the client's legal claims.
We have a caller that gave us another question that they're going to take on the air. One sexual harassment claim the caller was aware of happened years ago when these claims were first starting to emerge. The claim was settled with a payment to the victim, but part of the settlement required her to leave. Then the harasser was terminated. And the caller wanted to know, are settlements requiring both parties to leave? They may have been typical, but is it really fair to the victim? Or might that also be a disincentive for victims coming forward if the end result is they lose their job?
It's atypical when sexual harassment victims come forward, the harasser can often be fired. And actually, if they offer a settlement, which they often do, they will often want the victim to resign from their employment in exchange for the settlement. You can see that happen. It's not fair to ask the victim to do that, and they're not required to do that. But I think in practical terms, what would happen is an employer would offer less to settle a claim if the victim was not willing to resign from employment. And also, once an employee comes forward and complains about sexual harassment, the workplace often becomes so uncomfortable that they don't want to work there anymore anyway, and they also don't want to work there anymore anyway because of being sexually harassed.
I'm going to ask you to think about my next question for you in a moment, but we're going to get to that in a moment. But I'm thinking in terms of both what an employee can do to protect themselves. You talked about that in terms of bullying. I'm also curious about what an employer can do. There's been no claim. They're not aware of anything going on. But what an employer can do looking forward to make sure this type of conduct doesn't emerge in the workplace and they don't face these claims. Before we get to that, I would like to welcome Ken from San Francisco. You're on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Hey, good evening. Question. I think I have an inkling of the answer, but I'm wondering if there is a lesser protection given to temporary employees or contract or probationary employees. I was a probationary employee for a state agency, and the person training me was really verbally abusive, and it involved a headset, wearing a headset, and every time I adjusted it, she would grab my hand and put it down and told me I look like the cover of Mad Magazine, and I explained this to my supervisor, and she told me that the big supervisor repeated all my complaints to her. And so when I spoke with a labor lawyer, she basically advised me, it's not worth your time to litigate this, because even if I was able to keep you on the job, then they'll just let you go for any reason. And so basically she advised me to look for another job rather than put myself through the stress of a complaint process. So I'm just assuming that temp employees, they can just not be renewed or what have you, or let go for any reason without specifying a reason.
Ken, thank you. I'll turn this over to both of my guests, and feel free to call back if you have further follow-up with the call. But as I understand it, what you're asking is there a different level of protection to somebody who is either a temporary employee or is still in their probationary period as opposed to a longstanding employee that's beyond their probationary period?
Well, I think it first depends on whether you're looking at federal or state law, because the FEHA does provide additional protections for all sorts of different positions, including, say, independent contractors or even unpaid interns or volunteers.
And Matt, just to be clear, FEHA, you mean the Federal Employment and Housing Act?
Yes, I'm sorry. It's the Federal Employment and Housing Act, which really offers much broader protections for employees than the federal law does, and something that we really try to steer our cases into state court to take advantage of that statute. But getting back to Ken's question, with temporary employees, you sort of have a two-employer situation. You have the temp agency, and you have the place where you've been placed. And in my experience, we like to go after both of those entities based on the facts. And it's called a joint employer theory. So depending on who knows what and where it's reported and how it's responded to, you can establish liability. But again, as Kelly was saying earlier, it needs to be at this point in a protected category that you're being harassed.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for calling in. And I agree with Matt. We do that as well. I would say that you have the same legal rights, whether you're a temp employee or a permanent employee or a short-term employee or a long-term employee. However, if you're just working somewhere for a short period of time, it's going to be harder for you to potentially establish claims, because employers often try to falsely claim that the employee had poor work performance, and that the only reason that you're coming forward with these claims is because you thought something might happen to your employment, or there are other ways that they try to undermine your credibility. So the shorter your length of tenure with a given company as a temp, the harder it can be potentially to prove your claims, unless you have text messages, emails, other witnesses, things that help establish the unlawful conduct that's potentially sexual harassment for you.
Ken, I hope that sums it up for you, and thank you. And if we could turn back, I mentioned a minute ago about preventative actions and what a employer can do to make sure that that atmosphere doesn't permeate the workplace and they don't get exposed to these kind of claims. And I would ask both of you, Kelly, Matt, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, there's a lot that the employer can do and really must do in this age. As Kelly was mentioning earlier, employers with 50 or more employees, they have to provide sexual harassment training for their supervisors every 2 years. So that's something that really needs to be closely monitored. The employer wants to put written policies into play that will show their employees what they need to do. They'll provide a really strong statement that the conduct is prohibited by the company, and they want to give the employee a clear procedure for how to make those complaints, who to talk to, what should they do if the supervisor is the harasser, who can they go to. They will want to describe exactly how they will handle a complaint. And they really want to stress in those written policies that they're going to not retaliate against employees or even witnesses that participate in an investigation. That's, as Kelly mentioned earlier, one of the biggest fears and bars for people coming forward or even being forthcoming in an interview. The company is going to insist in that policy that they're going to keep the names confidential to the extent that they can, and just encourage all employees to report any inappropriate conduct immediately. What I'm seeing is almost all sophisticated employers have these policies in place, but their practices are much different. And either they're untrained or they're too busy, but they're not following those practices and procedures, and that can really get them into trouble. There are other things that they need to do. Maybe Kelly wants to chat about those.
Sure. So I would say that one of the number one things that an employer can do to help contribute to a positive cultural atmosphere related to sexual harassment complaints is to, it's incumbent upon the employers to do everything they can do to create a safe environment and change the corporate culture so that women feel safe coming forward. So we have an old paradigm, pre-Cosby, pre-Weinstein, where when a woman came forward or a man regarding sexual harassment, it was assumed that they weren't telling the truth until evidence could confirm that they were. But the new paradigm, post-Weinstein and Cosby, and what employers should try to adopt is that to assume that the victim coming forward, that they are telling the truth unless evidence shows otherwise. So we need to have a reversal of the way that sexual harassment complaints are perceived and acknowledged and treated in the workplace. It's going to take time for employers to be able to do that, but I think if they can create a safe environment, it will increase the odds that women can come forward and sexual harassers will be rooted out sooner, so they're not victimizing multiple people.
And to that end, perhaps, Kelly, you could tell us, when you're starting to look into a claim, what are some of the things you're looking for that might be missing when you're looking at the various policies of the employer?
The policies of the employer?
Well, tell us what you're looking for. What Sure. kind of things might be missing that maybe they should be doing?
Sure. Well, as Matt was saying, most employers can have carbon copy, cookie cutter, boilerplate templates. So all employers can easily go online and buy all of the different policies that meet the legal requirements. There are actually some new regulations that have come down in 2016, which employers should be aware of in terms of things that they need to do and procedures that they need to have in place for sexual harassment complaints. But everybody tends to have the material. I think what's missing is the appropriate attitude and perception and treatment of the sexual harassment victims when they come forward. In my practice, that's what I think is missing.
Well, I would agree with that. I mean, I think in the post-Weinstein era, employers really need to set the tone at the top of the organization. If employees believe that harassment isn't going to be taken seriously or see these managers playing fast and loose with harassment or crude jokes, they're going to think it's okay to look the other way, or they're going to think it's okay to engage in similar behavior, and that needs to stop.
Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights. Tonight, we're talking about sexual discrimination, sexual harassment in the workplace. In the studio with me tonight is Kelly Armstrong, one of the premier sexual harassment attorneys in the state with her office in San Francisco. On the phone with me tonight is Matt Vandal, an employment litigator based in Sacramento. Again, he's focused much of his career on the representation of employers and is now representing employees. Should you wish to call in, our number is 866-798-8255, and we'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Thank you once again. Let's take up a case. An employee makes a complaint or makes a claim. Tell me about who investigates this, how does this break down, and what problems does that present?
So before an employee makes a complaint again, you want to contact an attorney and consult with them about how exactly you want your complaint to be worded, and you want the attorney to have a chronology of all of the information and details related to your employment and the sexual harassment. So your attorney has a really good overview of what happened to you and can prepare a summary of what happened to you, which best presents your facts in a way that best supports your legal claims. Once we have something like that prepared, actually what we do is we prepare something which is called a demand letter. So the demand letter outlines the employee's or the former employee's factual allegations and the legal theories which they support. We rely on a typed chronology and also talking with the client in an intake to put that together. And we also ask the victim to give us any evidence that they have, which confirms sexual harassment, such as text messages, emails, and let us know whether they have any witnesses who can support the claims. If they have witnesses, and before we come forward to the employer and make them aware of the claim, we spend a lot of time working on witness development. And that's where we would call a victim's witnesses and ask them what they saw, what they heard, what they know, what they can confirm. Many witnesses are afraid to come forward because they're afraid that they might be fired if they help a sexual harassment victim. So in many instances, we can keep witnesses confidential and anonymous during the early stages of a sexual harassment victim's case. Once all of that information is confirmed and compiled, we have all of the documents and evidence, we've spoken with all the witnesses, we have our demand letter, which outlines the sexual harassment, failure to prevent sexual harassment, intentional infliction of emotional distress, perhaps negligent retention if it's a known sexual harasser for the same employer. And then we make a monetary demand, and we send that letter to the employer. We have the client review it for factual accuracy, authorize the demand. Then we send it to the employer and give them 10 days from the date of the letter to respond. Usually their attorney gets involved and asks for more time to look into the allegations, especially since employers are required to investigate all sexual harassment complaints. And so then they ask for more time to look into the allegations and conduct their investigation. And as a professional courtesy, we say, okay. So I think Matt can probably talk about what might happen after that in terms of employer response.
Sure. When an employer receives a demand letter like that, oftentimes, you know, maybe a few days later, maybe a week later, when the employer is just sitting on that demand and not sure what to do or has to retain counsel. So that might be one of the reasons why the lawyers need more time. But a 10-day turnaround is really quick as well to conduct a complete and thorough evaluation of whether an investigation was done, what facts can be confirmed. You want to talk to all of the potential witnesses, anyone that happens to be referenced in the demand letter. Sometimes plaintiff's counsel, including myself, may not identify the witnesses in the demand letter because they don't want to necessarily help the employer, but oftentimes they will, and so the employer wants to talk to those people. They want to document everything they can. They want to gather as many documents or text messages or emails that they're trying to show that the conduct was welcome, or the complainant is exaggerating the claims, that they can't be supported by the evidence. so they're going to do that, and eventually, once they put all that material together, they'll either schedule a call with the lawyer that sent the demand letter, or they'll prepare a letter of their own responding back to that counsel, explaining their view of the facts. Many times you'll see a counteroffer to a demand letter or a request to see if we can resolve this informally or get into something called mediation, where the employer and the employee can sort of come together and see if they can resolve it without filing a lawsuit. But what I find is that those counteroffers are often insulting to the complainant. Employers will just try to brush off the allegations and say they're willing to settle this because they see it as a nuisance. And that's just outrageous in my view, but it's a very common strategy that employers seem to take.
So what we find when we send the demand letters and when we do our witness development, we don't reveal what evidence we have in the demand letter. We simply state what the facts are for the allegations and the legal claims. And usually the employer will deny everything or try to minimize the claims, et cetera. So we let them go ahead and do that. And then once we get their response, we show it to the client, we get their rebuttal comments, and then we prepare a rebuttal letter and we say, well, and many employers underreport to their own attorneys too, so it's not to blame defense counsel necessarily. So once we send our rebuttal letter, we say, well, and the employer has denied everything, we say, well, actually, we have multiple witnesses which confirm the following. And we don't identify the witnesses, but we lay out what those witnesses confirm. And if we have evidence, we can also say, well, actually, we have evidence that confirms that these different things were said and done, et cetera. We also attach a draft lawsuit to that letter and the DFEH paperwork, which is required for a FEHA claim. And we send it back to them and say, well, you need to engage with us in settlement negotiations or agree to go to mediation, or we're going to go ahead and file this suit. So we use the threat of potential litigation against employers to see if they will be reasonable regarding claims which are supported by evidence. And many times we are able to move our cases into an early mediation to try to achieve a reasonable damages and a monetary settlement for our clients so that they can have resolution and move forward with their lives.
Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights. On the phone with us tonight is Matthew Vandal. Matthew is a Sacramento-based employment litigator with the Arnold Law Firm in Sacramento. If you want to learn further about our guest, Matthew's website is https://www.justice4u.com/mat-vandal.html. In the studio with me tonight is Kelly Armstrong. Kelly's based here in San Francisco, and she's available. You can find her information on the web at https://thearmstronglawfirm.com. If you wish to have a question on air, have a question for our guest, the number here is 866-798-8255. And we've been talking about the bits and pieces of some of these claims, some of these cases. Could I ask you to walk us through the chronology? Somebody comes to an attorney and says, I've been sexually harassed at the workplace. Talk to me a bit about the process.
Well, the first thing that somebody needs to do is, you know, we send our clients instructions and we send them a sample chronology so they can tell the story of everything that happened at their job. We send them a sample witness list so they can see if their witnesses are willing to talk with us, even anonymously, where we won't reveal their name at this time. And then they give us a list of their witness names, what the witnesses' job title is, you know, who they are with respect to the employer, and also what they are witnesses for and their contact information. We would also ask them to provide us with the employer's sexual harassment policies, a paycheck stub, but primarily what we're looking for is the chronology, the witness list, and any evidence that they have to support their claims. And once we have all of that information, then we would go ahead and do the witness development to try to get as many witness statements as we could. And we would also prepare the demand letter with the factual allegations and the legal claims, as well as the monetary demand. You know, in addition to monetary damages, one of the things that we're also asking for now is that, as part of settlement, that the employer agree that the key employees involved undergo not online sexual harassment training, but actual live sexual harassment training as a required term for settlement. We can also ask for COBRA reimbursement for employees if they end up separating from employment or they've been constructively discharged because they couldn't stand working there anymore. We can ask for the employer to pay for outplacement services for them. You know, if somebody has been fired, we can potentially ask if the reason for their separation can be recharacterized potentially as a layoff, if that works and you know, is kosher pursuant to all the different requirements and laws. There are many different things that we can ask for in a demand letter besides just the monetary damages. We could ask for a letter of recommendation. There are just a variety of things.
Let me stop you there for a moment. We've got to the point where you've worked up the case and you send out a demand letter. On the employer side, is this the first that the employer usually hears about it is when they get the demand letter, or is there oftentimes a buzz or something that tells them something's underfoot?
Hopefully it's the first time they hear about the claims.
Well, in a perfect world, the victim of harassment would have come forward and given the employer the opportunity to do something about it. As Kelly was mentioning earlier, in certain circumstances, you know, the employee or a coworker has to come forward and give the employer a chance to do something about it. So it may be that the employer does know about it. They usually aren't going to tell you much about it when they receive a demand letter other than to negate everything that you're saying. But there are times. For example, Kelly was mentioning constructive discharge. If an employee is fed up and they need to leave and they can't handle it anymore, it may be the first time that an employer is hearing about it. They may be thinking this employee just resigned and is starting to collect unemployment because they had a change of mind. They might not know about it at all. Or if it's sufficiently severe harassment, the employee might just leave and go straight to a lawyer. Hopefully they will. And that's a circumstance where the employer could be hearing about it for the first time as well.
But my experience is that most employers, what they are most concerned with is their financial bottom line. And so if a sexual harassment victim comes forward, they're threatening that company's financial bottom line. So I have virtually, it's less than 5% of employers that I have dealt with in the hundreds of cases that I've done through the year. It's less than 5% of employers who are actually supportive and compassionate and empathetic as they should be when sexual harassment victims come forward. I don't trust employers to react appropriately and handle the claims as they should. I think that this is the best time in history right now in terms of the Me Too and Time's Up era for women to come forward, but there's still so much change that needs to occur, and it's going to take many years before that happens.
Matt, is that your experience as well?
Well, having represented employers for a long time and knowing that people are there making decisions, sometimes the people are doing the best they can based on what they understand to be the law or they understand to be the procedure. Sometimes they're just not trained properly. That can all come back to bite the employer, but it doesn't necessarily mean the people that are involved are inherently bad or they're inherently callous to the employee. But it does, I think Kelly is right, now that I've switched sides, I do see that a lot, and I do have a level of distrust for what the employer is saying, particularly as you see these demand letter responses coming back and just negating everything that an employee says when you have hard evidence in your hand that what they're saying is not true. But so I like to give the employer the benefit of the doubt, but now that I'm on the other side, I just don't see it supported in cases that are going to full-blown litigation.
A listener's called in with a question. A pattern that seems to emerge consistently is the unresponsive HR departments. Victims complain to HR and their complaints go nowhere. Apparently, HR, human resources, sees its role as protecting the organization rather than the victims, and try to discourage their claims. HR is afraid that it will be too destabilizing if star players were forced out. It's a hopeless conflict of interest. How can a company's internal structure be reorganized so that victims can be supported?
Just as we saw with Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose, Bill Cosby, Harvey Weinstein, Al Franken, our wonderful former senator from Minnesota, no matter who you are or how high level, you should be equally accountable for the laws. And I suppose an employer could try an intensive sexual harassment and sensitivity training with someone very high level. I suppose they could try that and see if they can change that person's behavior and let the victims know that they're doing everything they can within their power to address their concerns and ensure that the harasser doesn't victimize anyone again. But in general, what we're seeing now in our new Time's Up Me Too era is that men at the top are being asked to step down. And that's the risk for the highest level executives and managers out there. You can potentially be held as liable as all of these other high-profile men, and you're risking your entire life and career by continuing to think that you can get away with sexually harassing women.
And I do think that's a sea change that's come up in recent months, because historically, you have seen a lot of situations where the harasser is a high-level rainmaker, or somebody who brings a lot of money into the company, and the victim is a lower level, and the employer just wants to move them away and get them out of the way and out of the sight of this harasser and let him go continue to engage in whatever practices. He might be admonished or disciplined, but they want to keep him there. And I think that's definitely changing, and we're seeing that. So it's a hopeful time for women and men to come forward and raise these issues.
And again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights. Tonight, we're having an hour devoted to sexual harassment, its definitions, and its legal remedies in our evolving workplace. If you have a question for either Kelly Armstrong, Matt Vandal, or myself, you can reach us at 866-798-8255, or if you're in the San Francisco area, 415-841-4134. And where we left off, we talked about what each side is doing up to the point of a demand letter. What happens after the demand letter is received? Can you give us a sense of what each side is doing? I guess more importantly, from the perspective of somebody experiencing it at both sides, whether it's the employee who's made this claim or the employer who's received it, give us a sense of the experience each one is going through and what they are actively doing.
The experience of the victim and the employer?
Yes.
Well, the victim is terrified. They're used to keeping quiet and trying to save their job and not be stigmatized. They're used to potentially having coping mechanisms which involve repressing and suppressing their feelings, denying the memories, disassociating themselves from what happened, just so they can continue surviving and staying in their job. And so they're absolutely terrified to come forward, which is why it's so important for the lawyers also to provide a safe and supportive, compassionate environment for the victim to feel comfortable even coming forward with the attorneys. They're terrified even to call attorneys, let alone come forward against the employer. So I will say that the victim's stomachs are tied up in knots, their teeth are clenched, they have tension headaches, they're very, very worried about what might happen, and they're living in a constant state of, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? Is everything going to be ruined? I don't know. I guess maybe Matt could speak to what the employer might be experiencing.
And feel free to join in Kelly's comments if you want to share the experience of the employee claimant as well.
Exactly. We're so glad that Matt came over from the dark side.
Well, I do agree with much of what Kelly's saying, but just checking in on the employer, I think the employer is definitely concerned about their image. They don't want lawsuits being filed against them, accusing them of tolerating harassment or creating an environment that helps harassment continue. No employer wants that kind of press, and they certainly don't want a potential plaintiff or victim going to the news media and talking about them. So they really want to take prompt action there. And Kelly also mentioned earlier, the employer's concerned about their bottom line. And it's going to depend on the severity of the case, but they can be scared of that, wanting to take immediate action to try to stop the flow of cash coming out of them if there's a good claim. Employers can have to pay in a variety of ways, not just a settlement demand, but sometimes the higher level executives will have huge severance packages that they still have to pay out if they're going to discipline or terminate a high level executive, or problems based on recruitment and retention if their reputation is getting tarnished or they're established as an employer that tolerates harassment. So there's a lot of things that the employer is fearful of, and they want to take prompt action. They want to see if they have any opportunity to resolve these claims outside of litigation, because oftentimes these claims will go to as far as trial. We don't necessarily want to do that, but the employer will have opportunities to get rid of cases, and they just can't get rid of these cases before a trial setting. So they really don't want to expend a couple $100,000 getting there either, but they will fight if they have a good defense.
Employers can also lose customers, clients, and advertisers, and sponsors. So they can pay a high price in many different ways. I would also say that with sexual harassment claims, they're unique in that the victim can also bring claims against the individual harasser and not just the employer. So your harasser or perpetrator can also be liable to you for monetary damages in addition to the employer. And the individuals often have a lot to lose. They're often married with children in high-profile positions, paying a large mortgage, have children to put through college, et cetera, et cetera. So the victims, the female victims against male, are actually they're more in the driver's seat than they realize against the individual harassers also.
So what you're describing is that each side may independently the other have an interest in trying to resolve it before trial. The employer, because of protecting their standing and who they are, and the employee, because they don't want to face the emotional turmoil. But at the same time, each has an incentive to stand on principle, try to protect themselves, and that leads us into a fairly difficult situation for both.
Exactly. 98% of employment cases actually settle. And so with FEHA, if we win at trial, if we win a sexual harassment case at trial, we can also be awarded our attorney's fees. So it creates a very high risk for the employer in terms of not only having to pay for their attorneys to defend them, but also paying a potential judgment and also our attorney's fees with a potential multiplier and all of our costs. So there's a lot at risk for the employer in these cases, which makes mediation all the more appealing.
As we're nearing the top of the hour, can you take a few moments? I do know we have one caller on the line that's about to come through. And I'd like each of you to take a moment and sum up, if you could give some tips for employees and tips for people that have been harassed, what you can suggest. And similarly, if you have any for employers as well. Before we do that, though, we have Elizabeth from San Mateo on the line. Elizabeth, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, thank you very much. One thing that you haven't talked about tonight is a situation that I have seen in several workplaces where I have been, where a female co-employee has deliberately, and I stress that because in one case the woman told me this is what she planned to do, planned to come on to the boss in order that she could get him interested and in that way get herself better assignments, better bonuses, perhaps a raise or a promotion. And I have seen that this works, but my question there would be, when that kind of an arrangement comes to a bad end, how do you know, since right now the feeling seems to be that the accused harasser is guilty until proven innocent. How do you establish that the boss in this case was at fault, or establish that he wasn't?
Hi, Elizabeth. Are you talking about a situation where conduct was consensual for part of the time, but then there reached a point where the woman no longer wanted to offer favors in exchange for employment benefits? Is that what you're asking?
Actually, no, the other way around, where the boss wanted nothing more to do with it.
Elizabeth, thank you for your question. I'm going to ask that you take the answer on the air. We are running out of time. I want to give each of our guests a moment or two to respond quickly.
I think that this highlights the importance of documentation. If there's a sexual relationship going on and either side changes their mind, particularly if it's the man in a position of power, he's going to want to document the reasons why he is distancing himself from the relationship, maybe keep breakup messages to a coworker in writing and explain how much that relationship meant and why he needs to move on at that point to protect himself from liability. Otherwise, you won't have much evidence. It'll be a he said, she said.
Yeah, I agree with Matt that it's the evidence and the documentation which would be most important to confirming the male's version of events.
Elizabeth, thank you for your question. We're running near the top of the hour. I'm going to give each of you a moment or two to sum up any last-minute thoughts or any tips you have.
So I have a number of different tips, but I can give a few tonight. What I find with sexual harassment victims and trauma victims is that memories come out in layers sometimes. Trauma can affect your ability to remember everything all the time. It could also, you might bury memories, etc., especially if you're experiencing something painful. So if you're experiencing inappropriate behavior in the workplace, I would keep a journal, keep a typed journal on your computer or somewhere where you date the entries and you put down all of the different details, the context, other people that may have been witnesses, etc. I would also say avoid drinking alcohol with superiors and co-workers. There's a high percentage of calls that we get where for sexual harassment where alcohol is involved. Don't compliment your boss. Don't be afraid that you need to compliment your boss who is sexually harassing you to keep your job. Don't be effusive, flirtatious. Don't text smiley faces and emojis and tell them they're the best boss ever and what a wonderful boss they are. There are ways to respond neutrally without being effusive, such as, okay, thank you. Let me get back to my project since you gave me that deadline.
Thank you. And Matt, any last thoughts?
Well, just to give the perspective on the employer, I think it's really important for them to set the tone at the top, to encourage their employees to speak out, make sure they're doing a prompt and thorough and independent review of complaints, and even expand for-cause terminations to include violations of sexual harassment or policies. So those are some important considerations for employers, and I agree wholeheartedly with what Kelly had to say.
I'd like to thank both of my guests tonight. With us in the studio has been Kelly Armstrong, founder of the Armstrong Law Firm in San Francisco. With us by phone tonight, Matthew Vandal, employment litigator with the Arnold Law Firm in Sacramento. I'd like to thank both of you for participating tonight. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights. My name is Jeff Hayden. And thank you for joining us.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org.